Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Just in time for Mother's Day, Randy Fertel joins us to reminisce about his amazing mother, Ruth Fertel, founder of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. And if your mother loves brunch, author Kit Wall has written a book she'll love. Kit's newly published cookbook, New Orleans Classic Brunches, just might inspire you to cook for mom yourself this year. It's Mother's Day on this week's Louisiana Eats. We first spoke to Randy Fertel last fall when his memoir, The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak, was published. For Mother's Day, we thought it appropriate to hear from Randy again about his mother, Ruth Fertel, founder of the now worldwide Ruth's Chris Steakhouse chain. And now for your mama, Ruth Fertel. The whole course of her life, I think, was altered that day, May 24th, 1965, when she took possession of the Chris Steakhouse on North Broad in New Orleans. Tell us what led up to that day.
Well, she was a hard-working gal, and they had this litigious divorce that went on for years and years, and finally it was settled, and she didn't think she could afford to send me and my brother Jerry to college on the $380 a month she was making. So she found a three-line one-ad, steakhouse for sale, owner retiring, call this number. And he wanted $18,000, and my mother took that to her banker at Bank of Louisiana. And he said, well, this looks like a good deal, but you know, Ruth, you're going to need some working capital for inventory and stuff. So she was very capable, but she wasn't really ready for prime time. And he helped her through that first hurdle of making a go of it. So it started slow, and she was serving maybe 35 steaks a day. And one day she was complaining to one of her customers about, you know, slack business. And he said, oh, I didn't know you wanted more customers. Like she wouldn't. I didn't know you wanted more customers. I work in the oil patch across the river, and all those guys, they're from Texas. They know a good steak. So I'll bring them over here. Well, the next thing you know, it's the place for lunch for the oil patch, three martini lunches. And after that, you know, the politicians follow the money. So now it's the power lunch with the politicians and the uptown people. Before that, it had just been the kind of joint that you stopped on your way back from the track when you had a good day. So she bought Chris Steakhouse, and when it started expanding, she needed to change the name, so she added her name in that New Orleans tradition of stringing names together.
So steakhouses in America are a dime a dozen. What do you think set Ruth's Chris apart?
Well, they're a dime a dozen in part because of my mother. I once had the experience of chatting with Arnie Morton, whose family founded Morton Steakhouse. And he said, your mother created the prime steak business. I said, well, when did your family start? And he said, well, in the 20s. But I'll still tell you that your mother created the prime steak business. And I think what he meant was that she created the market. She created this much broader market. It wasn't this niche market. It was this really desirable thing that everyone aspired to and decided they could afford it, even if they couldn't, because it was so desirable.
So tell me, how did the enormous expansion take place from the one restaurant on North Broad to really the whole world?
Of course, the original was Broad and Ursuline, not Broad and Orleans, and it was this tiny little joint that had been founded by Chris Matalich in 1927, and it only had 17 tables. And in the early 70s, she had a customer, Tom Moran from Baton Rouge, who kept saying, Ruth, if you don't let me open my own Chris Steakhouse in Baton Rouge, then I'm going to kill myself on the highway, and it's going to be on your eternal soul. He was a dramatic Irishman. So eventually she, you know, got tired of his complaining and said, okay. And so he opened in Prairieville in the middle of chemical plants, and it was a huge success. It became the big political hang in Baton Rouge, and later he moved closer to downtown. But from that, you know, next Bob Ruby, who was a radio personality, took a franchise to Houston, and it just started growing. She was very early, I think, in this franchising of America movement, and probably I've never seen anyone on the high end like her. I think she was the first to do high-end franchising. And it wasn't about big franchise fee. It was about finding the right people who were going to be warm and welcoming and do the food the way she wanted.
How did she maintain the quality in all those restaurants?
Well, that was the big challenge. And there was a lot of ups and downs in that regard. And, you know, we'd get reports. And she often traveled to other cities to see what's what and try to adjust things. But, you know, the thing about franchising is that, you know, once you're in business, you're sure that you know more than the original. There's a story about Tom Moran that he was once a bit inebriated at the bar at the Ruth's Chris in Lafayette. And he was talking to Rosemary, the manager, and he said, you know why I hate Ruth Fertel? Because she's smarter than me.
Your mom was smarter than just about everybody,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, she was a whip.
Well, if your mother invented the prime steak market, then you literally had a hand in it because one of your early jobs was helping to butcher the meat. You literally wielded the saw, didn't you?
Well, I was an underachieving student at Ben Franklin in 1965 when she bought Chris Steakhouse. And so I was kind of looking for reasons not to study. So I started working as a busser and helped her butcher. And back then, there were only two steaks. Well, three steaks. There was, they all came off the short loin. There was the porterhouse, and there was the filet, which is the rest of the tenderloin, and the strips. So you had this 30 to 35-pound short loin, which had your entire inventory in it. And you had to cut through the bone with a hacksaw to get the steaks. That only lasted about a week, and then she went out and bought a bandsaw. But I helped her with that, and, you know, I was a young man, so it was hard work. But my mother was, you know, 5'2" and 110 pounds and throwing around 35-pound loins. So she was tough.
Tell us about your Uncle Martin's home remedy that ended up on the menu.
Well, I was really pleased. I was hanging out with my cousin Joanne in Houston, and we're driving along to go see another cousin. You know, I'm doing research. And she said, well, you know that cream spinach on your mother's menu, that's Uncle Martin's cream spinach. And that was such a revelation because Ruth's Chris does not trumpet my mother's roots in the Delta, but there's a number of ways in which Ruth's Chris really is rooted in that incredible culinary family that she grew up in. Of course, Plaquemines is where many of our foodstuffs comes from Creole tomatoes to oysters and shrimp and trout. So there's stories about my great-great-grandmother. She was known as Grandmom. She didn't speak English. She, for Christmas and Thanksgiving, would send the menfolk out in the bayou to get 17 sacks of oysters, which they would bring in and shuck on the back porch, and then she would make oyster dressing for 35. And for the rest of my mother's life, she recreated that dinner. And so when she opened Chris Steakhouse and she started expanding the menu, first it was just potatoes and salad, and then she, you know, added some other things. And cream spinach was one of those things she added. And that cream spinach was my great-Uncle Martin's cream spinach, and he was the great cook in the family.
Let's talk about how the race barrier was broken at Ruth's Chris. I was fascinated to read about that because people always think of it being a Dookie Chase.
Well, the first black man who ate at Chris Steakhouse, Lolis Edward Eli, great civil rights attorney, was invited to lunch at Chris Steakhouse. There was some white guy running for judge or something who wanted Lolis's support in the black community, which of course he wasn't going to get because Lolis was a liberal guy and this guy was conservative. But Lolas knew a good deal when he heard it. So he's a bon vivant. He wanted a good steak. So he said yes. So they go in, and next thing you know, the floor is a titter. And this white cracker, I imagine it was, walked up to my mother and looked down at her from his great height and said, "If that boy eats here, I'll never eat here again." And my mother, who was from the most racist parish in the state, but did not grow up racist with her Norwegian and Alsatian family, said, "Well, I'll see you." And and I just love that story. So the Public Accommodations Act was 1963, but I've heard it said many times that that barrier was broken storefront by storefront. And so it had to have been after 65. I'm not exactly sure if it was 65 or 66, but that's when Chris Steakhouse was integrated.
And it really was a great political hotbed. Please share with us the red beans and rice tradition on Mondays following elections.
Well, on Friday before an election, everyone gathered. I mean, if you were a political guy or a political hanger-on or a political commentator, you were at Ruth's Chris and you were watching what deals were being made and table hopping, and Hippo Katz was holding court. He was this wonderful, irrepressible guy whose name came from his great weight, and it was not a nickname you said behind his back. It was just his name, Hippo Katz. But he was this just uncanny prognosticator of elections, and he would make bets on, you know, so-and-so was going to win by 0.4% or whatever. So on Monday, everyone came to pay up their debts or scoop their winnings, and there was this tradition that the winners got a free steak and the losers got red beans and rice that my mother had cooked with her own hand.
But there was a little trick when the check came, huh?
Yeah, they paid full fare for the red beans.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
So happy to be here.
Randy Fertel, son of the Empress of Steak, Ruth U. Fertel. Great Uncle Martin's creamed spinach recipe inspired the rich, luscious side dish that helped make Ruth's Chris Steakhouse famous. As Randy crosses the country promoting his family memoir, he is sometimes persuaded to do a little cooking in addition to book signing. This is Randy's version of that famous family dish. Cook 3 pounds of frozen spinach in boiling water for 10 minutes. Drain and thoroughly squeeze out any remaining water. Melt 1 stick of butter in a heavy-bottomed pot and whisk in a half cup of flour. Continue whisking for about 3 minutes until the flour is cooked to the blonde roux stage. There's not much color change, but you'll notice the scent of the flour goes from a flat cardboard smell to a toasty, nutty scent. Slowly whisk in 2 cups of half and half. Add a bit of salt and pepper, then stir in the spinach. Add 2 more cups of half and half, a pinch of nutmeg, and voila! You'll have an authentic version of the creamed spinach that launched an empire. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org, where you can also email us with your questions and comments. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The answer to this week's question, what steaming Louisiana beverage occasionally appears in Terrence Osborne's art, is coffee. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
I was pleased to see so many familiar names in our inbox this past week. I want to give a shout out to regular participants like David Hubble and Judith Brown. But our winning prize is actually headed to a brand new contestant. Congratulations to Glennis Parker of New Orleans for winning this week's culinary prize. I'll be looking for your name this coming week.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the name of the iconic American chef and food writer whose foundation annually awards the best of the best in America's food world? Here's a hint. Kit Wall recently authored a book about the first 25 chefs to be honored with this award. Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the name of the iconic American chef and food writer whose foundation annually awards the best of the best in America's food world? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Prolific cookbook author Kit Wall is at it again. Her new book, New Orleans Classic Brunches, makes you want to pour a mimosa and get the party started. Kit, how did you decide to do this book?
Well, I've always loved brunch, and I like to write about what I like the best.
What was your first book?
The Arnaud's Restaurant Cookbook. Arnaud's and Archie Kasbarian, the proprietor, asked me to write their cookbook. I waded into that, ignorant and thinking it would be easy.
When was that?
The book took 4 years to write because I was still creative director of our ad agency, and doing that along with putting the cookbook together for Kasbarian. So it finally debuted just before Katrina.
And this is part of your series of classic New Orleans books. What are the other ones?
The first was dessert, because we all like our sweets. Then appetizers, because we wanted small bites, small plates. Then seafood, which, of course, is New Orleans. How more New Orleans can you be?
Yes.
Then gumbos and soups. And this one, brunches, is the fifth.
What's coming next?
Cocktails.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, I found that New Orleans Classic Brunches to be classic Kit Wall, from the jazzy prose to the excruciatingly tested recipes to the mouth-watering works of art that is Kit Wall's style food photography. Now, break it down for us and tell us, how do you go about working on a project like this?
Well, first we take a look at brunch across New Orleans, who does what the best and the most fun and the most interesting. And then some of the old recipes from the past that need a little highlighting.
Where do your recipes originate?
Usually from the chef at the restaurant that we decide might have the best version of something or an interesting version of something. It's pure serendipity.
You must have researched. I know how hard you work on these things. I know you must have looked at this every which way. So what did you discover about when brunch became a musical affair? Did you find the roots of this?
Yes, I did, and we can thank Dick Brennan for that. And as everyone knows, there's the huge Brennan family and many sprouts from that tree on. They started Breakfast at Brennan's in retaliation in the 40s because an author here published a book entitled Dinner at Antoine's. Well, Mr. Brennan thought, well, this won't do. I need to create an event that's a good idea. And so he was never one to let a good idea pass him by.
And, of course, that was Owen.
That was Owen. And then Dick and Ella went to Commander's, and Dick was in England and saw a jazz trio wandering around a restaurant performing as people dined. And he picked up the phone and called Ella back in New Orleans in the middle of the night and said, "Jazz brunch, jazz brunch."
Well, God bless him for those two words. So brunch usually means a party. Do you have any tips for how to throw a fabulous brunch and still have fun yourself, too?
Well, the first thing is to plan your menu, so most of it's done in advance. And the nifty thing about the brunch book is we disclose the secret of how to pre-poach eggs the way restaurants do and have them ready instantly.
Well, share that with us.
Well, basically, you halfway poach an egg, a bunch of them, and you slip it into the water, and you know where you put them. Mm-hmm. So when they get about half poached, then you pull it and with a slotted spoon and put it in a cold water bath and let it stay in the refrigerator once you've done all of that. And then just before service, you bring water back up to a boil and slip your eggs in and then plate them.
Well, congratulations on the new book, and thank you so much for coming to visit with us again on Louisiana Eats.
It was more fun than you can imagine.
Kit Wall, author of New Orleans Classic Brunches. For this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we explore the world of online publishing with Zester Daily's Corey Brown.
One of the challenges of being in the virtual world is to keeping up with the technology. We're just now rebuilding the whole site, bringing in a whole new architecture, because everything's changing so quickly. If you don't rebuild your site every few years, you're behind.
Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cookin' Magazine. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.